As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
I'm really pleased to say that joining us now on the phone from Paris at the OECD headquarters is Laurence Boone, OECD Chief Economist. Laurence, great to have you with us. You're just out with your year ahead, trimming the outlook, but seeing a much bigger problem potentially brewing for the decade ahead. Just walk us through what you're seeing.
So that's true. We've actually projecting growth to remain stuck at 2.93% for the next 2 years. And that's mostly due to all the uncertainty related to the trade tensions, but also to China economic slowdown and much beyond that, geopolitical and political economy uncertainty.
Laurence, how do you make a year ahead call? What's the base case around trade? How difficult is things this year?
Well, you know, the difficulty with the trade tensions is that they're very focused on a few tariffs, which have a direct effect on the price of imported goods. So consumers pay higher for what they buy. But the biggest effect is the uncertainty that's creating, because if you're a firm today, you don't really know where you're going to launch your next investment, because these trade tensions jump from countries to countries to start, and then there at heart there is a profound insatisfaction with the way that a lot of support to government subsidies, protection of intellectual property, technology transferred, all this is mingled within this discussion, and they are very deep-rooted problems that will take a long time to address.
Right. Although you are seeing a guarded optimism heading into 2020, a lot of economists and investors seeing a resurgence in the global economy. Can you square that with a deteriorating outlook from the OECD?
So I think there are two things to distinguish. If you get an agreement on what's called the phase one between the US and China, then yes, market will have some temporary relief and cheer up. But as I was saying, the issues surrounding trade are much beyond what we are seeing here. And they have to do with the way that digitalization has changed trade and commercial exchanges. They have to see with all the subsidies and form of government supports that are out there, which are undermining the level playing field. And these issues will take years to resolve, especially if we are just focusing on bilateral tariffs. It's like if you were focusing on the top of the iceberg when the iceberg below the sea level is growing.
Laurence, your predecessor at OECD, Catherine Mann, now at Citigroup, as at OECD, was quite strident about the roll-up that we're seeing in world business because of slow economic growth. She would speak of scale and the idea of monopsony, the idea of monopoly coming into play. We're seeing that in America this morning with a merger in discount brokerage reported of Schwab and TD Ameritrade. Do you in Paris still believe that we will see a roll-up of global business because of slow economic growth?
So there are things threatening globalization, and that's the trade tension that we have discussed, and it's also the possible tax fragmentation that the OECD is trying to address. And that relates really well to how our business is going to thrive in tomorrow's world. And for that, we need more certainty, more predictability, and a better level playing field. And that means, you know, ending this tit-for-tat tensions on tariff. It also means concluding, as we expect, the international negotiation on the taxation of multinational enterprises. As you know, we've been working on this for a while now, and we really think that we can conclude an agreement in 2020. That would change this pessimism of globalization.
I mean, what this comes down to, and Lawrence Boone, I'm going to cite here Meghan Desai at the London School of Economics, which is all of economics is about profitability. Given the OECD view, how you extend your timeline out to 2001, will there be a dearth of I'll get it out. 3, 2, 1. Will there be a dearth of profitability as we have slower economic growth?
Well, That's one of the things we're really concerned about. If you stay with very sluggish growth for a long time, then there will not be enough revenues there will be not enough growth to raise revenues, and that applies to people as much as it applies to businesses. And also, if you want profits to be lifted, you need investment, which is why we're particularly insisting on the need for government to level up public investment, because that's one of the main impediments to the implementation of private sector investment plans.
Lawrence Boone, thank you so much. We greatly appreciate it. Head of Economics, the OECD here. Right now, Joe Quidlin, who's with us with decades of experience at Merrill, Bank of America, private bank, and out, of course, with investment perspective. But Joe, you and I are going to wax philosophical here. Remember the first day discount brokerage showed up? You and I were like, what?
What? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Remember that?
We can't do it ourselves, but it was super cheap, and we all, you know.
They're never going to last. John, is discount brokerage a big deal in London?
FX brokerage. People like to trade foreign exchange,
yeah, too. Yeah, very well said.
Way.
We don't do that. But Charles Hu?
Right.
Remember that?
First, you know, open a whole new frontier for retail investors.
People laughed for about 6 months until, oh, so here we are with a mating here. And it goes to your work on a broader investment strategy to slower economic growth, challenge profitability. When in doubt, you have to mate. That's all it's about.
You have to look for that growth. Organically is very tough given the demographics, growth, lack of productivity. So, I mean, what's surprising me, Tom, like 10 years after the crisis, so to speak, we are starting to see some of the financial companies thinking about, you know, marrying or like at least observing each other.
And what comes out, this is TD Ameritrade, folks. Of course, Joe Ricketts' firm to be taken out by Schwab. It is presumed. It is not announced yet. CNBC reporting this and Fox Biz putting a $26 billion number on it. But it comes down to bring it over to John's world of yield, lower nominal GDP, some form of disinflation, and growth that just doesn't get it done, right?
Right. It doesn't get it done. It goes back to what we talked about earlier, Tom, like wanting and needing the scale. So if you don't have scale, you can't drive productivity or have the margin expansion. So this is about scale and reaching for that type of not organic growth, but kind of a merged growth.
I want to challenge the idea that this is simply a case of slowing growth and really raise the question of an existential crisis facing the asset management and brokerage businesses. People want stuff for free. And how long can mating and scale sustain businesses that ultimately are going to zero fee models?
Well, I would push back a little bit if people want it for free, because we've got a massive transfer of wealth coming in this country, like $9-10 trillion. And in the private wealth space, they still want that service. They still need tax strategies. So I think your average retail investor does want it free and is expecting it free. But there's also part of the industry where I still want to have access to specialty asset management. I still want access to credit. I want the full line of concierge services. So I do think there is a segment that wants it free. But when you look at $10 trillion in inheritance being passed generationally, that's not going to be done on a retail wire.
Do you see people willing to pay for that? All the services that you just described?
They're willing to pay for it, but because of the competition, yes, the margins are coming down, absolutely, which means we, anyone like Bank of America or anyone in the industry has to be more productive, has to have the right products in place and drive that growth.
End up in this really strange world where companies like Charles Schwab and TD Ameritrade end up making money like little banks. A little bit of candy for the deposits they have, take in a little bit more candy on doing other things with the money. What do you think of that as a business model, that all of these companies just get bigger and start behaving like little banks?
Like little banks. I mean, I work for a big bank, so I mean, I'll preface it with that. We'll see if it works or not. But yes, it's part and parcel of the lack of growth, right? It's part of that. Like, I got my model isn't producing what I expected in terms of revenue or profits. What do I do next? And you know, rarely is that sustainable, and or is it being set up for more mergers?
Got to talk about your broader market strategy as well. I said at the top of the program, investors at the moment seem to be lost between cautious optimism and total confusion over everything around China. How do you have any kind of optimism going into next year without any real clarity on some of these big issues?
Well, I mean, look at earnings. Third quarter earnings weren't that bad. They're better than expected. You know, the economy is chugging along at 2%. It's not great, but we're in, you know, 11th, 12th year of the expansion. The Chinese economy is growing at 5% plus. Europe is looking slightly better. Put it this way, Europe is looking less bad. So globally, we're bottoming out. The manufacturing numbers are getting better, but it's too early to jump with both feet. So, you know, whether it's healthcare, technology, robotics, automation, there's places to put money to work in equities.
Are you sustaining U.S. dominant investment? Do you still believe U.S. large cap will lead after an up? What are we up, 24%, 22%?
I think dominant will become more balanced next year between more developed Europe, Japan, and then the emerging markets. But, you know, the emerging markets, we've been waiting for
exactly
that.
What's the cat? I mean, is it China trade clears?
I think it's China trade clear, but you know, the emerging markets, I would just not throw that term out of the vocabulary and look more specific at, say, at sectors, at countries, technology versus consumption. That's the key.
This has been wonderful, Joe Quinlan.
Thanks,
thank you so much for being with us with a ton of breaking news.
A potential tie between Charles Schwab and TD Ameritrade. Yeah. And as far as I know, Tom, no comment from either company.
I agree, and it's good that you state that. This is a bit odd the way the flow is coming out. I know Fox Biz put a $26 billion statistic on the deal, about 5x sales.
A tie-up would create a firm with roughly $5 trillion in combined assets.
Yeah, and what's interesting,
some serious AUM.
Jim Cramer's shop, really interestingly, I didn't know this. Schwab's commission trades, it's only 8% of their business, where TD Ameritrade, it's what you'd expect, it's 23%.
We mentioned this on the program, and Lisa weigh in. It's the banks, the little banks within these brokerages.
Yeah,
that's how they're making the money.
It's the hope to bring in customers that they can actually make bank on other layers of revenue streams. But here's a question. How much are people willing to pay for that? When do they sort of demand free services there too?
How do you make money from it? That's a big question. Joining us in the studio, I'm really pleased to say, looking forward to this interview, Lale Tovcholo joins us now, JOHCM Senior Fund Manager. Good morning to you, Lale.
Good morning.
We won't be talking about TD Ameritrade and Charles Schwab. I can see you bracing for a potential question on that. Don't worry. You know what we will talk about? Bill Dudley's piece out on Bloomberg Opinion in the last 24 hours. Bloomberg Opinion columnist, formerly the New York Fed president, and of course he worked at Goldman with you many, many years ago. Lale, his comments on triple Bs, that's where I want to start. Whenever this conversation comes up, anyone outside of the fixed income world says this is a problem. Everyone inside of the fixed income world that I get to speak to, Lisa and Tom have conversations with as well, say this isn't a problem. Walk me through the issues at play here.
Sure. So, well, first of all, I'm really excited because I'm on the same height as Tom, because usually I feel like a shrimp.
You've got the chair lifted all the way up. This is exciting.
The issue is I ate so much at lunch yesterday.
You're weighing down the chair a little bit.
Two whole bowls of soup.
Wow. So the facts are correct. The triple Bs as a whole is about half of the U.S. investment grade index. And I think when you look at the largest, and I actually came armed with data, if you look at the top 13 issuers within that, the debt numbers are staggering, right? So the top issuers would be something like AT&T, $190 billion of debt. And you go down the numbers. But if you look at these top 13, what's unique about them is, with the exception of the auto and energy, where perhaps you have a little bit more, well, you have more exposure to external shocks that may not be in your control, everybody else has a very steady revenue stream. So the deleveraging path is there. So I don't want to ignore the fact that they're a large component. I just don't think that people should be as alarmed as they should be.
Okay, so then is the risk of some sort of fallout from the corporate debt buildup that Bill Dudley was flagging, is that overstated or is that risk still there?
Oh, I think the corporate debt buildout, I think the risk is in a different way. So to me, you may know these numbers, but I think it's a staggered number. The U.S. IG and high yield number is about $8.5 trillion now. It's 2x since the financial crisis. And if you look at the debt in these credit assets that's in daily liquid mutual funds, it's about a little over a trillion, okay? If you look at the U.S. broker balance sheets of daily inventory of how much they're willing to trade and sort of keep on the books, $12 billion. So to me, the mismatch is not necessarily these things are going to get downgraded from triple B to double B and the high yield is going to be a total utter disaster. To me, the issue is how do you, when the selling point comes, how does the plumbing work? Because I don't think that's been tested, and I don't think people understand that.
So what do you think will happen, Lali? How do you think things will function?
Well, it's going to be a price discovery. So it's good in that, I don't know. I mean, I think you may test where your marks are not accurate. It has nothing to do in some cases with the company's health. It's like selling your house, right? Your house is worth what somebody is willing to pay for it. You may think it's $1 million. It depends where the bid comes in.
So I spoke to PIMCO about these kind of issues earlier this year, and they said just in terms of their investment strategy, the way they want to play this, and I'll say this quite simply, and you can add some nuance to it. We want to be liquidity providers, not liquidity demanders. Wait for these kind of gappy moves in credit and then deploy capital. Lani, can you be that patient? Can you wait around for those kind of things?
You certainly can. But look, I mean, this is it's a pet peeve of mine, and nothing against PIMCO. People always say there's cash on the sidelines. There's no such thing as cash on the sidelines, right? Nobody has bags of cash sitting in. It's sitting in something else, right?
And usually, Tom Keene actually has bags of leveraged cash.
All right, and gold.
Firmly on the sidelines.
That's what he's sitting on.
That's why my height today. You're sitting under you is the leveraged cash. Continue.
Oh boy, this conversation is getting dangerous. When big fallouts happen, big wall events happen, the markets are connected, right? Everything kind of moves. So you have to sell something to fund something else. And that's where, you know, it becomes a lot difficult. So yes, in concept, can you buy 100 million, 200 million? Sure. Can you be able to deploy billions and immediately be able to take advantage at that time? I don't know.
The solution always is they extend duration and extend maturity. Is that the trap of next year? When in doubt, go from X to X plus one, X plus two. Is that what's going to happen?
I don't know. Duration, I think, is a very tough call. We played around with it a little bit, and we played around in the context of, look, I think we're a little unsure whether the recovery is happening or not, so perhaps we're better off just literally buying 10-year treasuries and just not taking the credit risk as opposed to an IG credit.
There's also something that you were talking about before, which is liquidity risk. You hear a lot of investors saying that they are going into less liquid credit for the extra premium. Embedded in what you're saying in terms of the structural issue, the plumbing issue in credit markets is, I believe, compared to what you said last time you were here, you are not taking liquidity risk and you'd rather go into stocks than riskier debt at this point based on liquidity. Can you give us a sense of where you are on that now?
Same playbook. We run a daily liquid mutual fund. I mean, I like to think that I will never get a redemption, but that's just not the real world.
So credit funds investing in stocks.
Well, we run a commingled product, so it's not a pure credit. So it's credit and equity. But we'll always run it liquid. And look, there have been numerous evidences of these liquidity issues popping out and funds unwinding over the last several years. We just treat them as they're episodic, and we just blame the manager. The underlying symptom is the same thing. You reach for yield, and you went illiquid. And frankly, I have a hard time when I buy a mutual fund to figure out what they own. You really think people sit there and go through the line items?
Lali, thank you. As always, thank you for joining us. Lali Topcholu there, J-O-H-C-O.
Don't trip over the leverage
cash. Senior fund manager. I thought I'd cut the interview off so Lali can get away to to television and run out of the studio.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
It's just to give her,
she's actually
give her
going to run.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Kathy Jones is with Charles Schwab, and the way the game is played, folks, is if you're on staff, and particularly if you're on research staff, you can't talk about the business. She's looking at her phone through the whole interview.
So don't ask her about the business.
We're not going to ask her about the business. Okay. And, of course, the reports this morning of a meeting between Schwab and Ameritrade. We will move on to fixed income, and the host of The Real Yield will drive forward that conversation.
Let's talk about it, Kathy. You have been a lot more conservative about your views in risk assets and fixed income. High yield is getting back out to in and around 400 basis points, just looking at that spread. Kathy, your thoughts on the riskier parts of fixed income at the moment?
Yeah, John, we haven't really changed our view. This, as you know, that spread has been widening, narrowing all year, back and forth. And our concern is, you know, it still hasn't changed, that we've had deteriorating credit quality, much more leverage in the corporate bond space than I think is justified by the rate of growth. So corporate profits are growing much more slowly than corporate leverage. And all that sets us up for, we think, is some sort of a correction in the market. So we're underweight high yield and continue to think that that's just a too risky an area to have a lot of exposure right now.
Kathy, this has been an area that people have been hating on for a long time. Junk bonds, not a loved asset class, even as they've rallied. Now, however, Goldman Sachs Asset Management, among others, are starting to kind of tiptoe into even the triple C rated debt, the lowest tier of junk bonds. And I'm wondering, what are they getting wrong in your view?
You know, I'm not really sure why you would be crazy about triple C's, except that they've underperformed the rest of the high yield market. So maybe they, you know, maybe there's a view that they can take advantage of a convergence between triple C's and the rest of the high yield market in a benign Fed scenario, which is what we have. But it strikes me as the old idea of picking up nickels in front of the steamroller. You know, it's not probably a game that most people want to play.
What's the trigger here to spur the sell-off here?
Well, I think you could have a couple of things. One could be that the leverage gets to be too much for some of the players, and we start to see some weakening there, the spreads blow out that way. So more economically driven than anything else. And it might be just sector-based. You know, we've already seen underperformance by energy. If you had another sector that suffered, that could be the case. Or it could be the surprising strength in the economy, which leans people towards viewing that rates might actually go up for safe assets. Now, we don't think that's a real likely scenario, but that could also cause high-yield spreads to move.
Kathy Jones, the charm of what you do and Lizanne Saunders does every day is you understand flows of retail like no one. What are people actually doing with their money in fixed income? I'm fascinated by this. Are they, you know, you say, well, I want you to buy a 2-year coupon. You're like, really? Or are they all out of 20 plus years trying to make total return?
Well, you know, of course, we have a wide variety of investors.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of investors have been staying very short duration because, frankly, the yields aren't that attractive to take on duration risk. Yeah. Some have been moving into riskier assets, but I would say it's mostly a pretty much a short duration, high quality story for many investors.
I look at full faith and credit and credit versus the credit market. And I guess you can pick up yield there. How much do I actually pick up if I go into the credit market versus government bonds and paper?
So if you're in investment grade, you're going to pick up 100 basis points or so, 1%.
1 percentage point.
Change. Yeah, in a higher quality investment grade corporate bond. And the other thing is we have a lot of investors in municipal bonds, and actually after tax for many investors, municipal bonds make more sense than, say, tax.
Okay, great. But what's the movement in muni bonds has been extraordinary this year. I mean, can you state that muni bonds price up, yield down, or price to perfection?
I wouldn't say price to perfection, but, you know, clearly valuations, particularly at the short end of the curve, have moved this year. As you go out the curve, valuations have actually improved because we've gotten a little bit more supply.
Let's bring some life to the investment grade part of the market, Kathy. We've had this big discussion over the last couple of days about triple Bs. It's come up so many times over the last couple of years. For anyone outside of fixed income tuning in and interested in the concept, if you look at the market, every security that comes to market will have a credit rating. The line in the sand between investment grade and junk is triple B. And within the triple B complex of big well-known companies like Ford, AT&T, the likes of AB InBev. And the worry is, Kathy, that in an economic downturn, these guys won't have done the hard work, the balance sheets won't look good, and they'll drop down to junk status. Kathy, just weigh in to that broader debate at the moment.
Well, it's certainly a risk. We know that a lot of those companies have stated that they're focused on maintaining a triple B rating and not getting downgraded into junk status. But, you know, good intentions are just that, good intentions. So if we were to hit a downturn and you would see some of these big companies downgraded, the market for high yield is much smaller. The pool of buyers is much smaller than in the investment grade area. And the worry is if you get one of these big companies that gets downgraded, you have a lot of securities hitting the high yield market. And inevitably, there's a big price gap that the whole market would probably feel.
I mean, this, to put this into English, so we could do this with Lisa Bramo, it's Farm Girl. At Fargo, North Dakota, I mean, the 20-year piece out of Fargo, North Dakota is a 4% coupon, priced to 110, yield to worst is 3.3%, and I'm enjoying a 2% coupon right now.
Fargo's reliable. I actually, that's probably less risky than other areas. Well, I'm just saying.
No, but that's an example of where it's a 4%.
Lisa feels like she just made an investment call.
It's a 4%.
Do you want to take that back?
I'm getting, no, I'm not saying that.
4% coupon.
No, I'm not
going to
take it back. I stand by it. Listen,
2%
no, I, Kathy,
for 20 years?
Before we let you go and before we start talking about the Farm Journal, I do want to get your sense on liquidity risk, because this is something that Lali Taptolu was just talking about, that she's really concerned about a breach in the plumbing. Do you buy that? Is that still a concern, even though most people seem to have forgotten?
Well, it's obviously still on the radar, but I think the Fed has made huge moves to address it right now, so I wouldn't be as concerned as we were 6 months or a year ago. You know, it's funny because it all sort of came to a head in September when we had the spike in the repo rate, but this is something people have been talking about since the Fed started to unwind its balance sheet. So I think they've taken huge steps to address it, and I'm much less concerned than I was a while back.
Kathy Jones, great to catch up with you. Charles Schwab, Chief Fixed Income Strategist.
We finished strong today. Through my morning, it has been spectacular to touch upon the Bloomberg New Economy Forum in Beijing. And of course, the highlight of this, without question, was Neil Ferguson's conversation with Henry Kissinger. We are now almost 50 years on from what those of us of a certain vintage remember is absolutely shocking. I can't begin to calculate the shock of that 1971 morning into 1972, as President Nixon went there. I've actually, Paul, had the honor of being at the Peace Hotel in Shanghai in the room that Henry Kissinger was in literally the night before he flew to Beijing to get this thing started. And we have the right guest now. He is Ambassador Baucus. He's a gentleman from Montana. Of course, you know him from his public service to the nation as a senator and as our 11th ambassador to China. We're just thrilled, Max Baucus, you could be with us today. Max, you were at Stanford, and then on back to Montana as a politician. Do you have a recollection of that absolute shock when America woke up and Nixon so changed that moment with China?
I do. I very much do. And I remember the photographs of
occurred there when Nixon went over. It's interesting to me, too, this is not really directly on point, but Mike Mansfield, a former ambassador,
yes.
I came across a speech he wrote in 1966 explaining why the United States should spend more time with China and understand China. It was the best, most effective statement I've ever read by anybody on any subject. And I talked to Henry Kissinger about that just last week. And he said, yes, Mike had a big influence on our going over to China, on President Nixon going to China. So, yeah, I do remember it.
And this was so important, folks, because Senator Baucus and Senator Mansfield and others in the House and in the dialogue were so isolated from a discussion that came out of all of World War II in the fractious 50s and 60s. Here is Henry Kissinger today with Bloomberg in Beijing, Max Baucus, looking at the foothills of a Cold War. How close are we to, it's a beautiful phrase, how close are we to the foothills of a Cold War after what you've observed with U.S.-Chinese relationships in the last year or two?
Well, we're slipping in that direction, unfortunately. And I think it's, first of all, it's somewhat natural, rising power, established power. People have talked about this so-called Thucydides trap. But we're kind of accelerating it. The United States is. We're not helping manage the relationship as well as we should. And in the same vein, President Xi is pretty nationalistic, and he also is, I think, contributing to the problem. We have two very strong-willed people each side of the Pacific, and neither one wants to really do a deal in the way one should do a deal.
So, Senator, there seems to be bipartisan support that there needs to be a real frank dialogue between the China and the U.S. about trade. So that seems to have some support. Where do you think this may be going wrong here?
I think, frankly, I don't mean to sound partisan. I think part of the problem is President Trump's approach to this is a bit flawed. He is trying to shake China up by slapping these tariffs on, and that, frankly, is not working. Our trade deficit now is much higher now than it was back when he took office. Second, it's not going to hit the heart of the problem. The heart of the problem clearly is the structural problems in China, you know, forced technology transfers, subsidies, and the like. But to solve it, you need, frankly, somebody to sit down, a president who understands this, a president who really wants to solve it, and does so privately, not publicly, without using Twitter, and starts to build up trust and confidence with the Chinese. That hasn't happened.
Senator Baucus, because of news flow, we're going to have to keep it shorter today, and it's most regrettable, but I must touch upon Hong Kong. Senator McConnell has provided leadership, and with Senator Rubio of Florida, in making a statement about Hong Kong by our legislative branch. He succeeded in that with the Senate and the House waiting for the president's signature on a legislative effort to tell and send a message to Beijing, and for that matter, to Carrie Lam in Hong Kong. Is this appropriate foreign diplomacy by our legislative branch?
Frankly, I have trouble with it. It's not going to help the protesters. Frankly, it will probably hurt the protesters, because if the United States does not give a special status to Hong Kong, or if it sanctions certain people in Hong Kong or China over human rights, that's going to set back the protesters. Second, it's going to also put another nail in the coffin that's driving the U.S. and China apart from each other. It's going to very much upset China. And third, it's not going to help us get a trade deal. Frankly, if I were in the Senate, I'd vote against it. This will hurt the protesters, not help them.
Senator Baucus, thank you so much. He is the 11th ambassador to China for the United States, and we're thrilled to get you to join us today. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.